Hello and welcome to the Open Goal podcast, keeping the ball on the ground in association with our friends at William Hill. Delighted to say, once again, joining me, Mark Guidi, I've got our very own Simon Ferry. How you doing, Simon?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Not bad. You look nice and fresh, actually.
I've been for a 10k this morning, mate. Nice, a wee glow bit.
You have, actually. Aye, you've got a nice wee glow.
It's the best you've seen, isn't it?
Unusual for a Tuesday morning. You're looking well. Cheers, now, mate. I know we've pulled off some top names in the podcast in the past year or so, haven't we? We've pulled off a few belters, but sitting alongside you, we're in the company of greatness. We've got the legendary music writer, one of the top show business people in the UK, alongside us, Mr. Billy Sloan. Billy, good morning.
That was a fiver well spent. He said, if you want a good intro, get the money in the post, so that was a fiver
well
spent. By the
way, I like the jacket. Yeah.
You like that?
Yeah,
huh?
I thought I'd try,
and even though it's only a podcast, I thought I'd try and look smart because the competition's dreadful.
It's the same material as my face, leather.
It's dreadful.
Now, we'll get on to Billy's story later on with all the great interviews that he's had and show business. But just to give you a wee flavour, because we're going to talk about the football, we'll talk about Scotland, we'll talk about Harry Redknapp in the jungle, and we'll talk about Billy's show business career. His great contacts, great friends, such as Marty Pello, Jim Kerr, Bono. He loves his boxing. He's met 18 world champions of boxing, including Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, Mike Tyson, Roberto Duran, Sugar Ray Leonard. Wow. He's also met and interviewed Pele, Ronaldo, George Best. But above all else, and we'll get into it, he's a soap addict. He's met and interviewed Norris. Norris and Rita for the corner shop, and apart from he's a brilliant writer, a brilliant broadcaster as well on BBC
this
Scotland and at Radio Clyde. But
he missed
his calling. What he really should have been, he loves his grub. He should have been a food critic. Yeah. You really wanted to be a food critic, didn't you?
I could be a food critic still. I mean, you know, I do like my grub. It has to be said, you know, I like a wee bit of late night scran.
I remember when we were at the Sunday Mail together, every January we used to do a diet challenge. You know, you would come in after the excess of Christmas and New Year, and there'd be six or seven days, there'd be wee Scotty McDermott, Gordon Waddle, Billy, be a few of us, and we'd go on the scales, we'd all put in 50 or 60 quid, and the winner at the end of the month would have lost the most weight would get the kitty. So Billy comes in, he starts, he goes on the scales, whatever he is, bum, bum, bum. He said, right, so he's opening day. He went right down to the canteen, the two rolls and sausage.
See, I didn't want to, because it was a significant kitty at 50 quid a head. But had I won it, I would just have got the money and went straight to the Shish Mahal. So it was probably a blessing. And the great, there was a great line from Scotty McDermott in the Sunday Mail, you know, when somebody says, "You cutting down a bit, Scotty?" He went, "Yeah, I'm down to two chicken Kievs a day."
Followed by an angel delight.
He's fading away to a baby elephant, that boy.
Anyway, brilliant. Right, we'll crack on. On to the football. Scotland, Saturday night. No, it's just Tuesday, and we've got the game tonight at Hope Me Israel. A game that we need to win to finish top of the section and get a playoff place. But Saturday night, Simon, 4-0 against Albania. Terrific result, great performance.
Brilliant. Really, really good performance. I thought it started really well. Went one up and then went down to 10 men. I thought we sat off the game for a bit, for the next 10 minutes. When we went down to 10 men, it was a bit... When the other team went down to 10 men, sorry. I was a bit baffled by that, but then get the second goal and really comfortable. And not just that, some of the football we played was outstanding. I mean, Wee Forrest's second goal was brilliant. Yeah. What was it, 20 passes or something?
Yeah.
For left back up, and then his finish was outstanding. So, really positive for Scotland. Looked like a young, dynamic team that can play. That's the best I've seen Scotland play for a long time.
And there was plenty of energy in the team as well, which was good to see Alan McLeish picking a team like that.
But I mean, the result was fantastic, but, you know, you're looking at it and thinking, you know, why can it not be like that all the time? Because with the best will in the world, you know, you should be beating Albania 4-0 365 days of the year. But, you know, the team seemed to have a bit of belief. I don't know if it was anything to do with all the, you know, the multiple call-offs, and the team was a bit of a patchwork quilt. It was almost as if when the guys ran out the tunnel, they thought, you know, we've got to kind of prove ourselves all over again here, because, you know, they really put in a shift, and I was delighted. I mean, you know, hopefully it's not going to be a banana skin when it comes to Israel, you know, later tonight. But, you know, it would be absolutely fantastic if, you know, Scotland could keep that level of momentum, because it was a brilliant performance and a sensational result.
If I knew Simon, watching your old pal Stephen Fletcher back in, leading the line, scoring. You must have been delighted for him.
Brilliant. Obviously, we met him on Tuesday when we were doing Andy Robertson. Great to see him again. He's a proper character, Fletch. He's good. He'd be good for the young boys because he's got a bit about him. I think he'll take on the role that Naismith had, where he'll get onto people if they're not doing it.
Is he a leader?
He's
off
a
the
leader.
Park, yeah.
I remember when we were younger, I've told you, we used to do crossing and finishing. If you crossed the ball over his head, he would just catch it and volley it away. He's one of the guys, he expects high standards, Fletch. And he'll bring that to the squad. And he's got a great personality. And above all, he gets a lot of stick, but I'm telling you now, he's a top player. He is a very good player, Stephen Fletcher.
Get into the game, Billy, there was a lot of negativity, particularly towards Alan McLeish, you know, the 9 or 10 call-offs and players don't want to be there and da-da-da-da-da. Do you think that would have been used as a bit of motivation for Alan
McLeish? Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I feel quite sorry. Sorry's probably the wrong word for McLeish because, you know, he's between a rock and a hard place. You know, he's come in to do a difficult job. He's only got the players at his disposal. Then you've got to be immediately suspicious and think, you know, the call-offs through genuine injuries, or is it just the fact that, you know, somebody's got a wee niggle and they think, well, we don't want to play for the manager, so you know, we'll just sort of give it a miss and maybe catch up the next time, or catch up when there's another manager. So as I said earlier, without a shadow of a doubt, you know, the guys who came into the team at the weekend, you know, they've been going all out to prove themselves. And, you know, it'll be difficult for a lot of these guys who were in the call-offs to get back in. I mean, you know, they're supposedly drafting John Fleck in for tonight. Now, I would like to see him, you know, getting a game at some point, because I think he's a good sort of organiser in the middle of the park. You know, we need somebody that can hold the ball and somebody that can kind of, you know, have a bit of a power and a bit of muscle in there. But, you know, why change a winning formula? You know, 4-0 and at the weekend, you know, it's going to be difficult to sort of meddle with that to an extent. But, you know, hopefully it doesn't become the proverbial Scotland banana skin and, you know, we pluck, you know, defeat from the jaws of victory. But fingers crossed that it goes our way.
Well, do you think, Matt, I think Fraser and Forrest wide is a must.
Yeah.
Any chance you get to play the two is a front three with the two wide left and wide.
Just
they're
so direct, aren't they?
Exactly.
You know, you're
and
giving
you need
the
that
ball
with Scotland. When you're not great at keeping the ball, you need guys that can get a hold of it and run up the pitch with it. I thought they two were outstanding, really good.
Do you expect Israel to be on the back foot tonight? You really think Scotland will take the game with them?
I do. I really like that Scotland team. I like the whole setup, you know, with an actual left footer at left back and a Callum Patterson at right back. The three in midfield are great. Three guys who can run, can tackle, can handle the ball. And then, as I said, the two up front with Fletch. I really like the balance of the Scotland team. And I can see them take it in tonight, and I think we'll beat Israel comfortably.
Look, longer term, I know we need to take it one game at a time, particularly when there's so much riding on tonight. But longer term, when you're talking about that team, you like the look of the three in the middle of the park, etc., etc. Andy Robertson, the captain. Can you see Kieran, guys as talented as Kieran Tierney and John McGinn, struggling to get back into the Scotland team?
Oof, it's tough, isn't it? I think Tierney will get back in. I think he will get back in.
But he ain't going to be left back though, is he?
He'll play right back, I think.
Right back.
I think he'll play right back. John McGinn, I think he'll struggle to get back in there. I think Christie's in the form of his life, really confident, looks like a proper player. And the one guy that I want to mention who I thought was great, and I don't know why he's not being called up, was David Bates.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a no-nonsense centre-half, it heads the ball and kicks it. We've got players in front of him that can play. I thought him and McKenna looked really good next to each other. He looks like a big, strong boy. Really like Bates. I even liked him at Rangers. I thought he was a right good defender at Rangers. Never made many mistakes. He's went over to a big club in Hamburg and done well as well. So
yeah, it's a sore one for if you think that Steven Gerrard had to bring in three central defenders. I know it was a situation that he inherited not having David Bates, but when you look, you know, wasn't there a lot of money that they missed out on him for in terms of getting him on a new deal?
Well, I think if you young Scottish boy and you get a chance to go and play it, but no, it's not the Bundesliga, is it, Mark? It's the one underneath that.
Yeah, Bundesliga too.
Club like Hamburg. And that'll bring his game on massively, playing in Germany. I mean, the coaching and the players that you'll play with over there, it's a massive loss for Rangers, I think, because he'd be a Rangers centre-half, no doubt.
Do you like David Bates, Billy?
Aye, and I mean, I think, you know, as Simon says, you know, going to Germany, you know, everything about it's, you know, win-win. You know, it's a great place. I've been to Hamburg. In fact, the first time I ever went abroad, I went abroad with Rory Gallagher to Hamburg. It was like Forrest Gump. I'd never been out the country before, and I had to get a passport and go. And it's a great city, and the whole German way of life, you know, the whole efficiency and the diet and that kind of thing. I mean, there's no way that guy's going to go and play in Hamburg for a number of years and not come back a better and improved player. In every single respect, not only just as a footballer, but as a person as well. And when you think of the Scotland players that have been to Germany, you know, Mark McGee being a great example, you know, I mean, they've all come back. And they've all, you know, prospered when they've been out there, so I can't see him being any different.
The only thing is he'll probably need to factor 50 out there, wouldn't he, with that? pasty white skin.
Yeah, he will.
Hamburg's right up the north towards Scandinavia, isn't it? So it's
you
not,
still need it.
You, for him,
any glimpse of sunlight,
it was good enough for the Beatles, it's good enough for him.
In terms of, so we're confident, we're hopeful that we get a victory tonight to be top of the group. But we need to look at the alternative. We don't win tonight, we don't finish top of the group. Will there be calls for Alec McLeish's head?
I think so. If we're done the top of this group with Albania and Israel, then I think he'll go. There'll be calls for it, definitely, but ultimately I think if we don't win this group, Alex McLeish will be out of job, I think. What do you think?
Well, I was going to, Billy, would that be fair considering, yeah, he's had 10, 11 months in charge, but tonight is only his fourth competitive game?
I think it's a results-led business, mm-hmm. and you know, when you look at the statistics and you see, you know, does he get through the group or does he not get through the group? But having said that, you know, if Alec McLeish is told, you know, thanks but no thanks, realistically, who do you bring in? You know, there's not a big rush of applicants, you know, queued around the building for the job. And at the end of the day, you know, when McLeish comes in, he's only really got to sort of work with the players he's got. You know, unfortunately, we don't have a Kenny Dalglish, and we don't have a Billy Bremner, and we don't have a Graham Souness, and we don't have an Ali McCoy. So he can only work with the people he's got. So, you know, it's a bit of a poison chalice all of a sudden. And, you know, if I was to put you on the spot at the moment, say, right, who would be the three contenders for the job? A, would they make any better job of it? And B, would they want the job in the first place? So I think you've got to give them a bit of time, but the results speak for themselves, and if he doesn't get through the group, it's going to be too much.
Denny Venables would take it.
Why do you say that?
Well, because...
it's a long-standing
Denny
job.
We love on here.
We always like Denny. We had him like to the Albion Rovers job a couple of weeks ago, then Kevin Harper beat him to it.
No, I've never met him.
It's a running joke. We're going to get him. I think actually he's a number two.
I don't know why I get too near him in case his permatan rubs up and I get he's on my shirt.
I would think Alec would struggle to hold his job if they don't win tonight, purely because you've got to judge the mood of the supporters, mm-hmm. and the supporters, there's a bit of apathy. Certainly, okay, Saturday night was positive, but I think longer term, when you're trying to put bums on seats inside Hampden and get 40,000-50,000, you know, you might struggle if Scotland don't win tonight. Who's the contenders?
Moyes.
I don't know. Yeah, David Moyes, he's out of work. Looking closer to home, just that your thing, you've got Malky Mackay already in the SFA, you've got Stevie Clark at Kilmarnock, you've got Derek McInnes at Aberdeen. There's contenders, mm-hmm. but I think it's only fair that we give Alec the chance to go and win tonight and support.
The problem with that is, you know, you're saying, you know, Stevie Clark and Derek McInnes, you know, they're picking a team and playing week in, week out. Suddenly, you know, you're in a job where, you know, by the very nature of it, you know, it's a game every 6 or 8 months, and, you know, you get the players together for a weekend and you play a game on the Saturday and a game on the Tuesday kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Would Stevie Clark want to give up the cut and thrust of, you know, week in, week out, you know, yeah. picking a Kilmarnock team, Derek McInnes challenging for cups and challenging for the title? It's a big ask for them to give up something as good and fulfilling as that.
Yep. Well, what we'll do is we'll stay positive, yeah. because we want to win tonight and we think that we can win. What's your prediction? Who's your key players tonight, Simon?
Forrest and Fraser. 2-0 Scotland, goal each.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yep. 2-0.
Clean sheet, yeah. Bates good. And McKenna.
I think that's spot on. I mean, I think, you know, Scotland could win 2-0. Just, you know, don't do the usual and, you know, lose a goal, you know, midway through the second half and then the panic sets in. But I think Scotland are more than capable of beating this Israeli team, without a doubt.
And hopefully we get a good crowd tonight as well. It's important that the Tartan Army are there and get behind Alex players. No, I'm not going.
It's Emmerdale, River City, EastEnders, and he can't go.
I'll tell you, Frank Mack's going, isn't he? Frank Mack, if any's going, he told us in the coup.
Mack are going, yeah.
He's going, so there you go. That's enough. That's all you need.
Are you going, Billy?
No, I'll be staying in
Simon?
River City.
I'm coaching the Nightmare, I would be there.
I'm not asking what you're doing, I'm asking if you're going to the game.
No, I'm not going, no.
Right, okay. I'm making dinner, so I can't go. Now, you're one of your cheeky wee tweets. I don't know if you'd had a couple of pints on Saturday night. What are you?
No, I had a couple of pints.
The AstroTurf. You getting the AstroTurf down the Livy boys in for the game?
It was a good tweet, wasn't it? I think it's a great idea. See, if it's a draw you're needing, mate, get a Hampden AstroTurf and Livingston will get you a draw against anyone, I'm telling you.
Right, let's hope we get a victory. We're all thoroughly behind Alec McLeish and his players on the Open Goal podcast, keeping the ball on the ground, and we hope that Alec and his players get the result that we need to top the group and get into a playoff for Euro 2020. Right, moving on. The Jungle Television, Billy, I know you love your programmes. Harry Redknapp, H has been he's been great value so far, hasn't he, on it?
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, I have to say, you know, a lot of people shy away from I'm a Celebrity, but I'm a sucker for it. I would love to have a go at it. I would love to have a go just to see what it would be like if you could, you know. And I think that the person that wins it, they should keep them in for another week to see how they fare on their own. But I think Harry Redknapp will be great. I mean, he's already sort of, we've had a few laughs from him, and it seems a good kind of squad this time. And of course, the word is that they're going to bring Noel Edmonds in as the kind of, you know, the secret, you know, participant.
£500,000 or £600,000 fee, ball accounts.
So that'll you know, set the cat amongst the pigeons. But it's great, and it's always worth watching just to see what happens. I thought it was great, and those challenges, you're sitting at home thinking, could I do them? And I mean, I'm claustrophobic. I don't like heights. I don't like creepy crawlies. I don't like rats. I'd be the perfect person in there. I'd be a bag of nerves.
John Barrowman's like a warrant.
He's good. I remember years ago, and I'm going back maybe about 30, 35 years ago, when I was just starting in the Sunday Mail, and a guy used to phone me like every 6 months, go, "Ah, oh, I'm a singer, you know, I'm in the musicals and stuff like that. Can you, you know, you write something about me?" And of course, he was a very nice guy, but you couldn't write something because he was totally unknown. And it was John Barrowman. He used to phone me week in, week out. And no, he's done well. He's
was
done
that
well.
His name back then as well?
Aye, the John same Barrowman, name? Yeah, that was, I think he was, I don't know where he was singing, but you know, he wasn't singing big venues or anything like that, but I remember vividly he used to phone me up and kind of hustle me to give him a mention in the paper.
And was his accent the same 30 years ago as it is now?
No, I think he actually bought that accent from Richard Park. Richard Park was selling it. And, you know, he got the money together and he bought that accent from Richard Park.
Is he a good kisser?
Brilliant kisser. Not as good as Mark, but yeah.
What about Harry's decision to go into the jungle?
Amazing. I love it. I think it's brilliant. He cracks me up, man. You were talking about his wife last night, how she does everything for him.
That was
anything.
A great story about hosing the flowers the jet.
The car.
Trying to water the plants, he's just annihilated.
What was the other thing about? Is it Princess
Beatrice? Prince Beatrice got out for dinner and he's like, loves his horse race, and she's like, "Yes, my grand." He's like, "Oh, yeah, she won the Gold Cup." He's like, "Oh, the Queen owns that horse." And he's like, "Oh, it's Prince Beatrice." Never knew.
Jamie, this is Tom Atzy. Brilliant. He's some man. Love him. And Twitter's brilliant to see all the stuff from like putting his hand out the car. He was in the car window. Did you see it? It was like transfer deadline day. So, no, he's good value. Funny guy, Harry, isn't it?
We would like to see more sporting. I mean, we've had some sporting stars on it over the years. Would you like to see more?
Who, if you could pick somebody for Scottish football to go on, who would it be?
Oh, it'd need to be Macca. It'd need to be Frank. I'd put Frank McAvaney and Ali McCoist in together. That'd be a great double act, don't
it,
Billy?
They would win it. I mean, I love Macca. You know, every time I meet him, I bump into him in the tunnels, like, you know, and it literally is the where's the birds. And I remember I was walking along Gordon Street one day, and I went, Billy, and I looked in, and there was like, you know, all these arms and legs and bodies and hairs and boobs, and in the middle of it somewhere was the bald Macca. We're just going for a wee spot of lunch. I don't know where they were going. Maybe, you know, one of the lap dancers. Please, I've no idea. But what, of all the people I've ever met in my life, you know, what and you know, I get photographs taken with people just to have a record of who you. One of my proudest possessions, and it was we did a gig in 1999 for Kosovo to raise money for the refugees in the war torn Kosovo at the time. The Sunday Mail. It was a great gig we did at the SEC with Simple Minds and Big Country and Hugh and Crines, and Macca turned up backstage, and Jonathan Watson was the compere of the show. And he compared the show as Macca. So I've got this amazing picture of me in the middle and Macca to my right and Jonathan Watson as Macca to my left. And he looked more like Macca than Macca did. It's a great picture. Fantastic.
I would like to see him in it, but he would, let's be honest, he'd get to jail, wouldn't he? Something back. He would get flung off the show.
But I mean, there's been some good contestants over the years. I mean, John Lydon, I thought, was a great contestant. Yeah. He was a fantastic contestant. And then you're talking about sports people. You know, David Price, of course. David Hay.
Was in the jungle. Was good as well.
And did great business, you know what I mean? So it was brilliant.
And Mac has been on the shortlist a couple of times. Yeah, he's made the... Because I think what they do, they have about 50, 60 contenders and you get notified... You're in the running. And
see, I think if they'd have told him this year that the bird for the chase was in it, he would have went straight in. I think he'd have been straight in with that.
The gags, I mean, ITV, you could just, you could imagine them with, I was going to say Ant and Deck, but it's Holly and
if Holly was on it, he'd be giving her all sorts, wouldn't he? How funny, see, but we did a Coopin' show, I'm on it every Thursday, and see, before we go on the camera, he's unbelievable, isn't he? He's so funny, man.
He's part of his brother. I hope he gets on it. McCoist would be good on it as well, wouldn't he?
McCoist would be great. Aye, he would be very good on it, absolutely. Why don't you put McCoist, John Brown and Durant and Maka and Charlie Nick and throw them all in together and get rid of the rest of the contestants, just leave them in for a month and see how they go on. I would watch that.
It'd be top ratings. It definitely would be top ratings. Right, we've had our chat about football. As we say, with Scotland the best tonight, we've had our chat about the jungle, but let's zoom in on our special guest, Billy's own, Billy Sloan, even. Billy's, like I said at the top of the show, Marty Pello, Jim Kerr, Bono. Now, I always love the Bono story, and some people don't believe me of a certain age, Billy, but I remember it. Before social media, you two announced a world tour, and they didn't have a gig Scotland, and you came to the rescue, and Bono, was it Clyde? Was it George Bowie's Breakfast Show? Someone went on and gave an interview. What was it?
What happened was, you know, they announced a world tour, and they were playing everywhere, Zurich and, you know, Amsterdam and stuff, and there wasn't any Scottish dates. So, of course, as you can imagine, the uproar there was, we started getting letters, as it was in those days, or emails. There wasn't anything like social media back then. And saying, this is ridiculous, because, and it was, you know, the punters were making a very good point, because Scotland was the first place that really embraced U2 outside their native island. So I wrote a big piece in my column in the paper saying that this was an outrage, you know, that it was inconceivable that the band could do a world tour and no come to Scotland. Coincidentally, the following week I was down at the Brits and they were getting the main award at the Brits, and I bumped into them. And Bono says, what are they saying north of the border? I says, honest opinion, yeah. I says, your name's Mud. I says, they're really not very happy. I says, it's ridiculous and there's a lot of unrest. Oh, we'll do something about it, we'll do something about it. I says, well, you better, because it really has gone down like a proverbial lead balloon. So again, coincidentally, the next week, and this sounds very flash, I don't mean it to, I was in Tokyo, Japan, with a Scottish band called the Cosmic Rough Riders who was playing it there. I'd never been to Japan before, so it was a big deal, as you can imagine. And I got a phone call and a message in my hotel answer phone in my room saying, phone John Giddings immediately. Now, John Giddings is one of the major players in the music industry in the UK, and if John Giddings puts a call in, you call him back, you know, like that. And I phoned John Giddings, what have you said? What have you said? Hey, we're doing two U2 gigs. He said, we're putting the tickets on sale on Thursday. This was the Tuesday. He says, we're putting the tickets on sale on Thursday. I says, when are the gigs? He went, next Monday and Tuesday. And I says, you're kidding? He went, no. He says, I don't know what you said to them, but it hit the target. So literally, it was in the old days, you know, there was none of this phoning up and booking your tickets online with, you know, the computer mouse.
Queue up the sleeping bag and
the punters queued up. And what they did was they queued them right around Hall 5, because it was freezing, it was November. They queued them right around Hall 5. And, you know, the tickets, of course, sold out in a flash. And then it came to the Monday and Tuesday. It was on the Elevation Tour, I think it was. And, you know, we gave them a little presentation. We gave them a plaque thing and got our picture taken with the band before they went on. And then at the end of the gig, they were playing one, and Bono says, I'd like to thank the Cosmic Rough Riders for opening the show for us tonight. So that got a wee kind of round of applause. And then he looked down and saw me, because I was at the foot of the stage. He says, and I'd like to thank Billy Sloan, who was the worm in our ear, who kept saying, don't forget Glasgow, don't forget Glasgow. So of course, by this time, I've fainted. I've got birds kissing me and all that, right? And then a week later, a mate of mine who runs a record shop says, come down, I've got something for you. And he had a bootleg CD of the gig, and you could hear it as plain as anything. And I took it and I played it to my late mother, and I says, listen to that, Mum. And she went, I can't understand what that Irish boy's saying. So I went from the triumphant peaks to the depths of despair. But no, but that's what they're like. They're nice guys. I mean, I went to see them recently, just a few weeks ago. And I was going with my son down at Manchester Arena. And he couldn't go because my youngest granddaughter wasn't well. So we're watching the show, me and my mate. And I got an email from Bono's PA saying, what's your seat number? I've got something for you. And I said, it's section 103, row B, seat 33, 34. And Bono had written me a handwritten card saying, look, I've been having trouble with my voice. I can't, you know, get out to say hi. I'm in kind of lockdown. So he sent me this handwritten card and two T-shirts for my granddaughters. And then 5 minutes later, I got another email from the girl saying, but the Edge knows you're here, so if you want to come back to the Lowry for a drink after the show. So me and my mate went back and spent another. But that's what they're like, you know. I mean, that's what they're like. I mean, they came into Radio Clyde in 1981 on their first ever headline tour. They played, I think it was the 18th of January 1981, they played Strathclyde University with Altered Images as their special guest. And they came into Radio Clyde, and of course all the hotshots like Steve Jones and Dougie Donnelly and Richard, but I don't, you two, I never heard of them. And I said, I'll interview them. I interviewed Bono in the gents' toilet of Strathclyde University after the show, simply because it was the only place quiet enough and echoey enough.
And John Barman wasn't in there.
No, he wasn't in there because he was just leaving the cubicle as we walked in, and Mark Greedy was just and they were playing George Michael records in the background. But that's the kind of guys you two are. You know, that this is the biggest band in the world. You know, the opening night of the UK leg of the world tour, and he's sending me handwritten cards. He doesn't need to bother his backside. Yeah.
Tell me this then, when you're talking about, you know, other DJs and people in the music business, no bothering. Do you listen to them then before it, and they think you've got, and you think, you know what, I think those guys got something to, even though they're no famous, I think they could go somewhere and you got onto it.
I'm just a fan, Mark. You know, I just, you know, I'm a fan who got to kind of live his dream. You know, going to gigs and buying records. Suddenly there was people giving me tickets for gigs and giving me free records. But you know, somebody once said, you know, you should never meet your heroes, but they didn't know what they were talking about, because for every MC Hammer and Damon Albarn and, you know, Mick Hucknall from Simply Red, there's a Paul McCartney or a Mick Jagger or a Bruce Springsteen or a Ray Davies or an Elton John or a Rod Stewart or a David Bowie. So, you know, it kind of balances it. And, you know, I would just, you know, go on the radio, back in Radio Clyde in those days, around the paper, and if I thought a band were great, I just used to say, I think they're great, maybe you might like them as well. And, you know, I wasn't sitting with a crystal ball trying to predict who was going to be the next big thing. I just thought, I like this record, maybe somebody else will like it and give it a play.
When you talk about meet your heroes, just one wee quick story just about myself. One of my favourite bands growing up was Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, and they played in the Merchant City 5-6 years ago, and I says to Billy, any chance you could get me to meet Lloyd Cole? And of course he did, backstage, right into meet Lloyd Cole. One of the highlights
been
of my
therapy ever since. he's no tour since. he lives in Massachusetts. He's lying in a darkened room, going. I wish it, saying to himself, saying to his wife, I wish it'd been Hugh Keevans.
Right, on that, we were talking about all these names, and we'll get into more of it. But you started off in a building site. So how have you gone from being a labourer in a building site to one of the top music show business people in the UK?
At school I wanted to get into journalism, but it was difficult, as you well know, you've been over that course before. So when I left school I worked in a couple of offices, and then I got a job in a building site, and it was fantastic. I worked for the old Glasgow Corporation, as it was in those days, and you know, you were quite literally shoveling shit. You know, it was a hard job, it was a hard job, but it was great. You can imagine being in a building site with 150 guys and the crack in the patter. And we were in a building site down in Anderson, you know, the old Anderson bus station, and it was an empty office block, and we were kind of making it into rooms and all that kind of stuff. And I was the only guy in the job that didn't smoke and didn't drink, right? And they used to have a raffle every Thursday for the shop stewards fund, and I won the raffle 2 weeks in a row, and the prize was 40 fags and a bottle of whiskey. And of course the troops were like, that's ridiculous, he should be barred from entering and all that. But I loved it. I mean, you were as fit as a fiddle, eating like a horse, and I absolutely loved it. But then I got a chance to, I mean, back in those days I was about maybe 18, 19. Back in those days I was earning about 90, 100 quid a week with all the overtime and stuff, when my mates were earning 50, 60 quid a week. So I was in the money. And then I wrote away to my local paper, the Bishop Briggs and Springburn Times, and said, I noticed that you don't have a music column. I'll write one for free as long as you put my name on it. Thinking if I could build up a cuttings file, it would be something to show a prospective employer. And I got offered a job. You know, they were looking for a reporter to cover Springburn. And I went, and the woman offered me the job, and she says, the wages are £19.50. And I thought, how do I go from 90 quid a week to £19.50? But a wee bit of savings, so I just bit the bullet and took it, and that's how I got in. And suddenly I was covering council meetings and girl guide displays and the local guys playing football on a Saturday, and it was great training. I absolutely loved it, and that's basically how I got in.
First ever gig that you covered professionally?
First ever gig I covered professionally. I remember writing, this is a good one, I remember it was Jubilee year 1977, and I went down, I said to my mother, I'm not going to be around for Christmas dinner this year, Mum. Why are you working? I says, no, I'm going to Huddersfield to see the Sex Pistols. Oh, this is ridiculous, I tell your dad. It's only one day of the year the family get together and you're going to see a bloody punk rock group in Huddersfield. But I went to see this gig, the Sex Pistols played a gig in Huddersfield, this place called Ivanhoe's, and it's become a really iconic gig. You know, the band, John Lydon still says to this day, that was one of the most important gigs in their career. And I remember writing a piece about it for the local paper. It was in the Bishop Briggs and Springburn Times. I'm not sure what the the punters up in Spam Valley and Bishop Briggs must have thought of Johnny Rotten snarling at the pages of the paper. But aye, that's where it started. And then I just, you know, coincidentally, the woman who the editor, who was the editor, her husband was the deputy editor of the Sunday Mail, and they needed somebody to do the pop column, so I get drafted in, and the rest is history, as they say.
Brilliant. Now, Si sat down with Jim White, Sky Sports.
Yeah, brilliant, so, man, he was amazing.
He was brilliant, and beautiful, very early on.
Beautiful looking man.
He's looking great, isn't he? He's looking well. You get a few mentions because he was talking about you started off in show business and music and kind of vying yourself to try and get to get interviews, and he managed to get Bowie McCartney, as you have as well. Do you remember Jim back in the beat then?
I remember him vividly. I remember him because he seemed to get in the morning and he would go to makeup and get his makeup put on, and then I'd meet him in Boots like 3 hours later buying a baguette or something, and he would still have the makeup on. You know, he was an incredibly, you know, beautiful and attractive young male. But no, I remember working with him. I mean, I worked with him quite closely in a programme called Late Edition, which was this late night chat show that was on every Thursday. It was live every Thursday at 10:30, right after the news at 10, so it was a great spot. And the two presenters were Jim White and Kirsty Young, so it was a real big deal for STV back in the day. And my budget per show was, I booked all the showbiz guests, my budget was £125, so that didn't even cover you for a shuttle flight up from London and stuff. And I mean, I booked folk like Ocean Colour Scene, Squeeze, Delamitri, Joan Armatrading, Curtis Stigers, Mark Ammon, Spart. So there was a good lineup of musical guests, and we had people like Prince Nazim Hamed, he was the champ at the time.
Yeah.
Booked him. I booked Vera Duckworth from Coronation Street, your big favourite, Mark, your former girlfriend. And I booked Jack Charlton, was one of the. I also booked, I hate to say it, Jimmy Savile. That was one of the ones we booked, and he was one of the guests. And it was great to work in the programme because it was literally, you know, you were making it up as you went along. And it was good because, you know, I would, if we had somebody like Prince Nassim Hamed on the show, I would do notes for Jim and Kirsty Young, who were going to interview him. So I would give the notes to Kirsty Young and I'd give the notes to Jim, and Kirsty Young would read every last syllable of the note and come back 2 days later and go, see that bit on page 19 where you say that he did this and did that? Tell me more about that. Jim wouldn't even read them. He would just go, right, great mate, and throw the bit. And basically, when he was interviewing somebody, he would have three questions, and the three questions were, things are going well for you, mate, eh?
That sounds like me.
You're doing a lot at the moment, mate, aren't you, mate? So what's next, mate? And if you get somebody who was a talker, that was great. But if you get somebody who was like, yep, nope, mate, he then just went back to the first question. So things are going well for you, mate. I mean, Sam, I would give him all these notes. He never ever read them.
Oh, yeah.
But he was a great guy to work because he was so enthusiastic, yeah, and I liked him. And you know,
he's infectious, isn't he?
Infectious. And then, as they say in West Central Scotland, you know, he was a good foot in the door operator. You know, when you think of some of the interviews he's got, like Charles Green lying in the hospital bed, and you know, Bowie and stuff like that. And all that stuff. He was a good foot in the door reporter, and you know, his enthusiasm was infectious. But you know, he's never read a page of notes in his life. You know, things are going well for you, mate.
So you mentioned Prince Nazim.
By the way, he's been on the Scotty McDermott diet. Have you seen him?
Prince Nazim.
Oh, he's huge.
Absolutely.
I remember when I'd no long started at the Sunday Mail, and he was just coming to the fore and becoming world championship, getting back about 95, around about then, 96. And when he used to fight in Glasgow, he fought up here a number of times. Alec Morrison was the promoter, and he used to hold his press conferences in Sati Sings in Elders Lee Street.
That's
brilliant. When
he came into STV, you know, our budget, as I say, was top and safety. So we basically, you know, for the guests, the budget, you know, the rider clause was three cans of Coke, three cans of Lilt, two bottles of water, a wee dish of peanuts and a wee dish of crisps, and once that was done, it was done. And of course, Naz was coming in and he couldn't eat anything because he was having to make the weight. And he drank a bottle of water, and then he wanted another bottle of water, and of course we didn't have one, so I had to go and fill it up at the tap. And then when I walked up, I pretended I was taking the cap off to give it. But we had him on twice, and he was great. It was good value. We had him on twice, and he was tremendous value. And Kirsty was a fan of the boxing, so she liked him, and he got on very well with her. And in fact, she went to the fight with me, so he was a good guest. And Brendan Ingle, his legendary trainer, who sadly died a few months ago, he was with him as well. But we had to put him on as the first guest at half 10 because they had to get him back to get him into his bed because they didn't want him staying up too late.
He wasn't going into the corner of the Savaritan, though.
No, he'd had a takeaway for Shatty Sings before he came on.
Right, so world champions, we'll keep in the boxing theme now. Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, Mike Tyson, Roberto Duran, Sugar Ray Leonard, Marvelous Marvin Hagler. Wow. So give us a wee flavour.
I mean, you know, I remember I was in the Sunday Mail. I'm guessing what year it would have been. I think it might have been about 81 or something. And I got a phone call. They were bringing a movie that Muhammad Ali had a part in, and they were bringing him over to London. And they phoned me up and asked me if I'd like to do an interview, and it was bad for us, as you know, because the interviews were on the Sunday, so that's a whole 7 days you've got to keep the interview for the next week. So it meant that, you know, he would be all over the papers on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so by the time it got to the following Sunday, it would be kind of dead in the water for us. But just to go, and I make no bones about it, I just wanted to go and meet the man, because at that time Harry Carpenter, the doyen of British boxing commentators, alongside the late great Reg Gutteridge, of course, had said that Muhammad Ali was the most famous man in the world. They said that, you know, if you took him up 35,000 feet in a plane, put a parachute in his back and threw him out the plane, wherever he landed, whether it would be the Amazon jungle, Antarctica, in the middle of the desert, the first guy he met would know him. Mm-hmm. And it was true, he was that famous. I went away down to the Dorchester Hotel this Sunday and spent the day with him. We went to Radio 1, he was appearing in a live programme with John Lowe, the darts player.
Oh, aye.
And he had a darts challenge match. I don't know how you have a darts challenge match in the radio, but he was throwing the darts, it was like javelin spears, you know, the dart board was nearly... And I spent the day with him, and, you know, at that time, you know, he literally stopped the traffic because we came back into the Dorchester and he'd been up since 6 in the morning. He was kind of falling asleep, sitting at the table, eating a bit of chocolate cake and drinking a cup of tea. And this wee girl came up. This wee girl came up and she said, excuse me, could I have your autograph, please? So he kind of opened his eyes because he was kind of falling asleep, and his fingers were all covered in chocolate, you know, icing and cream for the cake. And instead he's saying, look, give me a minute. He cleaned his fingers, signed her autograph, and she went to walk away, and he went, little lady, haven't you forgotten something? And I thought, oh, what's going on here? And I said, well, I heard her saying please, and I heard her saying thank you, what's wrong with me? He went, haven't you forgotten something? And she was looking at him, and he went, my kiss. And she gave him a kiss in the cheek. And then, of course, a wee boy came up, and he signed the autograph for the wee boy, and of course he couldn't give him a kiss in the cheek, so he put his hands up, and the wee boy was kind of shadow boxing with his hands. And there was all these wee old ladies sitting having afternoon tea in the Dorchester, no less, and they knew nothing about boxing, and they all stood up and they gave him a round of applause. Oh, and that's how famous he was. So and then we brought him up, when I worked at the Record, we brought him up to Watson's bookshop at the corner of Gordon Street and Union Street to do a book signing. And this is the one time that Ali McCoy's ever turned up in time for anything. I phoned Ibrox and there was a guy called Peter who used to be the guy who worked at the door.
Yep.
And I says, Peter, where's McCoy? He went, oh, he's just finished training, he's just come out of the shower and all that. So I says, get him on the phone, Ali. So McCoy came on the phone. I says, what are you doing? Nothing. He says, I've just got ready after training. I says, right, I'm up here with Muhammad Ali, get your arse up here, I want to do a picture for the paper. He went, I'll be here in 20 minutes. And he was. Now, that's unusual for him.
Yeah.
And we did a great picture of Muhammad Ali standing as if he was going to punch him. And I always remember the intro. I says, this was the moment when Super Ali, A-L-L-Y, met the real Super Ali. And McCoy says to this day that of all the people he's met, and he's met a few, that was one of his proudest moments. You know, we got we get Muhammad Ali and him together, which was great.
I think I'm doing well getting Gary O'Connor, and this guy's going to be Muhammad Ali.
The football, George Best.
George Best was appearing. He was doing some talking thing at the Rangers Club, you know, the Rangers Social Club at the back of the Copeland Stand, as it was then. And I knew the guy who was organising it. And when I was a wee boy, you know, George Best was my idol. I had the white Hummel boots, you know, with the two black stripes, which were white for the first time you wore them, and then in the red ash and the black ash, they were all beaten up and stuff. So I had the Hummel boots and pictures of George Best on my wall, and the guy says, come down. So I went away down and walked in the room, and there was George Best. So I've got this amazing picture of me and the Belfast boy. I mean, I could barely speak, he was that great. And then you'll know the year, there was the Scottish, the World Youth Cup Championship was being held at Hamden.
1989,
and Scotland getting to the final, and they put, it was under 19s, and the Saudi Arabian guys were all 35 and stuff. They had beards and walking sticks and stuff like that. And the guest of honour was Pelle. So I was on a job in London, and I got a 5 o'clock wake up call. Got out to Heathrow for 6, got on the 7:15 shuttle, got home for 8:30, 8:45, got a shower, got shaved, put a shirt and tie on, which was unusual for me, and went in and met the legendary Roger Bailey and photographer Eric Craig, and they took me to Hampden, and there was Pelly as close as I am to you. So at the end of the press conference, when he was launching the event, of course there was a free bar, and all the press guys all ran to the bar, and he was just standing himself. So I'd been in if you say that was 89 and 87, I'd been in Brazil with Simple Minds, mm-hmm. and of course we all got bitten by the football bug and we bought Brazil strips, and I had a Brazil shirt, so I got him to sign it, and he signed it to Billy, best wishes Pelé, and I had a couple of pictures I'd nicked out the Sunday Mail file to get signed, one of which was a picture of him being tackled by Billy Bremner when Scotland played him in 1960, and Pelly looked at the picture and said, "I remember that game, so do my ankles," because of course Billy Bremner kicked him up and down, and I says, what was your favourite goals you ever scored? What was the two goals? And he said the first one was his first World Cup final against Sweden, where he headed, where he chested the ball and then let it bounce and scored, and then he said the second most favourite one was when the 4-1 against Italy in the 1970 World Cup final, where he headed it down, mm-hmm. and then he says, "What about you? What's your favourites?" And I says, "Well, it isn't actually goals." I says, "It was the time the goalie kicked the ball out and he volleyed it for the halfway line." I says, "But my all-time favourite was when he dummied the keeper, uh-huh. and it just went past the post." I mean, had that gone in, that would have trumped Maradona as the greatest goal of all time. But you know, just to stand there shaking the hands of the greatest, arguably the greatest footballer of all time, you know, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, and that, when you were talking about, you had a great phrase there in terms of, you know, for journalism, you said, well, Jim White is a great foot in the door man. Yeah, yeah. But you look at all the stuff, and we'll get the soap operas, the boxing, the football, the music. You've got to have a brass neck as well, haven't you? In a good way.
You've got to have a brass neck, but you've also got to have a passion for it. You know, I always say, you know, I mean, if you went to somebody in Sucky Hall Street in Glasgow or Princess Street in Edinburgh and said to them, like, here's the deal, for the next 6 months you can fly the world, you can stay in some of the greatest hotels, eat in some of the best restaurants, go to gigs like the Nelson Mandela Tribute, Live Aid, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you'll get to sit in a room with Mick Jagger, David Bowie, Paul McCartney, you know, Elton John, Rod Stewart, etc., etc. You can do that for 6 months, the guy would bite your hand off. I've been doing it for 40 years. But you've got to have a passion for it, because if you get to the been there, done it, got the T-shirt, you know, yawn, just forget it. And I mean, I still get excited, you know, when, you know, you're about to go and meet somebody, you know, I mean, I get really nervous, you know, even after all this time. If you're sitting just about to interview Mick Jagger, obviously you're going to get nervous, but you know, if you just treat them as people. And I think a lot of the time, particularly with the Scottish journalists, the English journalists were always kind of the opinion that they were bigger stars than the stars that they were interviewing.
Yeah.
So they would never ever in a million years ask for an autograph, and if they did, it would be, "Oh, it's for my pals, wee sisters, paper boys, neighbours, nephew." Whereas if I get an album sleeve signed, they'd say, "Who's it for?" And I'd say, "It's for me," and they were like taken aback. But they kind of got the vibe that you were passionate about with it, and you knew what they did, and so that's it pays dividends, because at the end of the day they're only guys or females, they're only people. So
who's your favourite person?
Well, you know, it doesn't get much better than, you know, Muhammad Ali. Paul McCartney's great as well. You know, you're sitting with one quarter of arguably the greatest group of all time, and the only problem with him is you interview him for half an hour, and he's a great interview. And then you say cheerio, and by the time you've left his office to walk back out, you've thought of another 8 million things you wanted to ask him. I mean, he was great. Bowie was great. I interviewed Bowie 7 times, and you know, I had quite a good relationship with him. You know, any time he did anything up here, you know, I did the interview with him. You know, Elton John's great. He's a big football fan. You know, any Elton John interview for the first 10-15 minutes, he's talking about, you know, I remember interviewing once, I don't know what period it would have been, at the SEC, and he was going on about Amoruso. Oh, he's a great player, but he's still got the pace, and you know, you need somebody that's, so it wasn't he just didn't know things in general. He actually knew what he was talking about. So there's people like that.
I remember when you told me, because I loved him, you should go and see him in concert, all his music, George Michael, and you get into his house to interview him down in London at his home.
I went to his manager's office, and the girl said, "We're just going round to the house." So I just assumed it was a manager's house, and 10 minutes later I was sitting in George Michael's, you know, living room while he was in making a cup of tea, and they were a lovely guy, an absolute, a gentleman, couldn't be any nicer. And just, you know, some of the incredible positions you find yourself in, you know, Tina Turner or Cher. You know, I remember one time I was uptown at lunchtime, And like I was saying earlier with John Giddings, if you get a call for John Giddings, you return it. Well, I get a message, Billy, this is Roger Davis, call me back immediately. This was Tina Turner's manager and the guy who transformed her into a star. And they'd been up in Glasgow. He was up in Glasgow with Cher, because he also managed Cher. And she'd seen a thing on Scotland Today, it was lunchtime, that they were going to shut the homeopathic unit at Gart Naval Hospital. And she was outraged because she had an illness and went to all these doctors and medical experts and none of them could cure her. But it was homeopathic medicine that kind of got her through the dark of the tunnel. And Cher wants to talk to you about this ridiculous. So I then did a phone interview with Cher. And you know, she was saying it's outrageous. She shouldn't be closing hospitals. She should be opening hospitals. You know, keep them open. And she donated €25,000 to the fighting fund. And then we went in and met her at the dressing room. And that. So I've got this picture of you'd like it, Cher, standing in this flesh-coloured body stocking. So it looks as if she's bollock naked. And you know, we ran it, and she helped to save the homeopathic unit in Gart Naval. And talking about, I know that your eyes, you know, widened when I said the words bollock naked now. But I once went to Milan for the weekend to interview Grace Jones, and we got there on the Friday, and Grace had been out to a party on the Thursday night and had come in and taken the phone off the hook and the do not disturb sign in the door, and we hung about for 3 days. We hung about to the Sunday, never saw her. And in the Sunday, AC were playing Inter at the San Siro, and I says to the guy, would I be able to buy, you'd be able to buy a ticket outside, it'd be about £40 or something. But I couldn't go because I had to stay in the hotel. And eventually we didn't see her, you know, we put the bags back in the hotel, the bags back in the taxi, and we were just about to leave, and the phone at reception went. And the PR guy went, you're not going to believe this, that's Gracie's guy, she's ready to do the interview now. And we says to the taxi driver, he says, well, it's a Sunday night, so the traffic wouldn't be bad, but we'd need to be off and running in about 20 minutes. Are you not going to make the plane? So we got to the room and it's chaos. Half-eaten room service trays, bottles of champagne lying scattered over, you know, clothes everywhere, you know, and all these people lying about in various stages of undress. But no Grace, I couldn't see Grace. And the next minute the minder guy called, beckons me over to the bathroom. He says, she's having a bath. If you want to interview, you're going to need to interview her. She's in the bath. I mean, you're kidding. He went, no.
Is Jim White in there, man?
No. Because Jim White doesn't bath. Jim White doesn't bath. That's why he puts it.
You're doing well, mate.
He puts the makeup on, it just stays on. So I walked in and Grace was lying in the bath. So I sat in the toilet seat. I put my tape machine in the bidet. And she was all covered in soap suds. But of course, the soap suds dissolved. But she got the shower head and started fluffing them up. But then after that, you know, she just let them dissolve, and I'm trying to maintain eye contact. I think when I wrote the piece for the Daily Record, I said that she had the most exquisite body that looked as if it had been carved from a giant bar of Cadbury's Bourneville. She looked amazing. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I says, we need to do a photograph. So she leaned over the edge of the bath, all covered in soap suds, and gave me a hug. I was sitting in the floor of the bathroom. And then the next week, by coincidence, she was on Dame Edna Everage, had a chat show on Saturday night. And I didn't see it, but my dad phoned me, mate, you've just been mentioned on Dame Edna Everage. You know, if it's Grace Jones said, this Scottish guy interviewed her in the bath, and when all the other journalists found out, they wanted to interview her as well, but she only ever did it the once. And then 6 months later, she was appearing in Birmingham, and I took the picture, and she wrote on it, splish splash, I was having a bath. Best wishes, Grace Jones. So
I've
been in the bath with Grace Jones. Luckily, I wasn't in beside her for her point of view. But
how you're talking about all these names there, but how proud is a Scotsman when you see, when you've watched them from their infancy setting out in music, like a Jim Kerr, Simple Minds, a Marty Pellow, wait, how much pleasure do you get seeing those guys and their bands grow?
It's great because, you know, music is genuinely like football and like boxing. It's one of the things that we Scots are genuinely good at. And when you think of, you know, two guys, you know, Jim Kerr met Charlie Burchill when he was 8 in a sandpit in Torrey Glen when they were out playing. And then suddenly, you know, the band are number one in America and they're instrumental in getting Nelson Mandela released from Robben Island after 26 years of incarceration. You know, I mean, it's beyond your wildest dreams. And this is two guys for a council house in Torrey Glen. Similarly, you know, the Wet 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 guys, you know, this was four guys who were on the dole in Clydebank, no job prospects, were on yacht schemes. You know, Marty was training to be a bricklayer, a painter and decorator. Tommy, the drummer, was, training to be a bricklayer. You know, and then suddenly 3 years later, their number one in the charts, the first of three number one records. So it's great. It's a great sense of pride. But I never get into this whole was like us kind of thing. You know, I mean, you're either a good band or a bad band, and irrespective of whether you're Scottish or Irish or English or Welsh or from any part of the world. But, you know, music is one of the things that, you know, we've been able to take worldwide. And when you think of bands like The Proclaimers and Travis and, you know, some of the bands I've mentioned there, you know, it's fantastic. And, you know, it's a great experience to see. You know, I mean, Lloyd Cole's a good example. Lloyd Cole came up to me in Nightmares in Sucky Hall Street, which was part of the building that got demolished in the Victorious fire. And this guy came up and instantly had an English accent, which made him kind of stand out.
Is he from Leicester? Is that right?
Derbyshire. And he handed me a tape and says, here's my band. I think we're the best new band in Scotland. If you like it, will you play it in your radio show? Everybody says that. But the band were great. They were called The Casuals. It was before The Commotions, and I played it. The song was called The Power of Love, and I played it on my radio show. And on the strength of that play, Polydor Records, all the record companies, because they used to listen to my show on a Thursday, they phoned up and said they wanted to sign him. And his manager was on holiday in Ibiza, and he went, you need to come. Lloyd phoned him and says, you need to come back. All these record companies are phoning me, and I don't know what to do, I don't know what to say. So the guy came back, and 4 months later they were in the studio, and 6 months later they were on Top of the Pops. Perfect Skin was a top 10 hit, and
Rattlesnakes album, right?
Rattlesnakes, yeah. And Lloyd still credits that on the first ever bio that they did. He said, if it hadn't been for this guy Billy Sloan in Glasgow, he said, you know, we bring this to the attention of the record companies, we would never have got off the start block. So you get a bit of satisfaction for that. You know, it was always the problem in the paper that you were dealing with middle-aged guys. So you go and say, you know, this new band for Ireland called U2 are going to be big, local, and they would look at you because they'd only ever heard the Barbra Streisand and Kenny Rogers. But, you know, they should have trusted your judgment, but they didn't. But they of course never ever came back years later and went, you were right and we were wrong. But
Well, you ever attempted to get into like the management side, like an agency side of the
business? I did manage a band very briefly called The Lift, and took their tape down to London just simply because they had been you know, I'd been playing it in the programme, and the first I get the subway, I get the shuttle down to London, got on Heathrow, get the Piccadilly line right into Green Park, walked around the corner to MCA Records, played the cassette tape to the guy, and he was levitating off the seat. I want to sign this, I know you're going to go to other record companies, but don't go, we want to sign it right away. So I walked back out to Piccadilly with my cassette tape thinking, this is a piece of piss, this is brilliant. Of course, the next record company I went to, the guy was ordering a sandwich and, you know, checking his emails and no bothering, he never even listened to the tape. The third guy said he hated it, but they got a deal. But I bowed out because it was their thing, and I bowed out, and, you know, they could have had a bit of success, but, you know, I just sort of backed off at that.
Right, we're going to round it off, so it's been great.
Oh, amazing, I'm wrapping the football and doing the music.
Give us your favourite gig, Billy.
Favourite gig would be, I think it's 1992, would be the Zooropa tour. U2 played two gigs at the Celtic Park in Glasgow, and it was memorable because, you know, Bono was dressed up as Mephisto. The band really were at the peak of their powers in a live sense. It was the perfect marriage of the music and the technology, the big screens, and I'm getting goosebumps just talking to you about it. And then halfway through the show, they did a video link to a bomb shelter in Sarajevo. And they had a woman on the video link who was talking to her son who'd managed to escape the fighting, and he was in the audience. So that was a magic moment. Also, talking of Celtic Park, went to see Prince once, and I was with a reporter, Marion Scott, from the Sunday Mail, that you know. She looked a bit like Morticia Adams, and she had been doing doorstepping Prince as he came in his private jet at Glasgow Airport. Now, if it had just been anybody normal, he wouldn't have batted an eyelid, but she was quite a kind of distinctive looking female individual. So Prince comes on stage, he's halfway through the first number, and I don't know how his security man did it, but in 35,000 people he spotted Marion Scott, and I was standing next to her. The next minute her and I have got our arms up our back, passes ripped off our shirt, and we get thrown out at Jane Field Street. We get thrown out at the gig. Prince hadn't even completed a song, and I'm standing outside Parkhead going, what have I done to deserve this? Luckily I had a couple of spare passes in the back pocket, and we just went in another door, and I says to Manny, whatever you do, stand up the back, that's it. So the U2 show would be memorable. You know, Frank Sinatra at Ibrox in 1990 for the Year of Culture, that was a great show. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, 2009, Madison Square Garden, That was magic. Live Aid, of course, the Nelson Mandela tribute concerts. There's too many to mention, but if you put me on the spot and said just mention one or two, it would be the two U2 shows at Celtic Park in the early 90s.
So that's your favourite gigs. Tell us then, your favourite singer in terms of a live voice, a live performance singer, standout singer.
I think Sinatra would need to be in there. I mean, I saw him for the first time in 1975, November the 12th. I think it was his birthday, in fact. No, December, so it was the month before his birthday. And in those days, gig tickets were like £2.50. And a ticket for Sinatra was £19.50. But I just bit the bullet and bought one and went to the London Palladium, no less. And it was Sarah Vaughan, Count Basie and his orchestra, and the chairman of the board. So that was a bit special. In terms of rock singers, Paul Rodgers of Free, Bad Company. I mean, I've interviewed him a couple of times, and I said to him, I said, I can't sing, but if I could sing, I wish I could sing like you. So there would be him. Roger Daltrey would be up there. Bono is a very underrated singer. He's a great singer. Robert Plant, obviously. George Michael, brilliant singer. So again, you've got a lot of choice.
Brilliant. Billy, it's been a pleasure listening to you, though. You sound like it's been a great, 56 minutes.
It's just good to come in and lift the quality of the podcast.
You know, usually scumbags have got.
You know, I mean, people have been saying, you know, the barrel has been scraped and we're below that. So hopefully we're maybe marginally above this week.
And honestly, I can't believe, because we used to work together for you, I can't believe we've got through 55, 56 minutes and he's no mentioned Barbara Dixon and Elaine Page, honestly. And I thought I knew you so well. Anyway, there we are. It's the William Hill podcast, keeping the ball on the ground. With Open Goal, thank you very much to Simon Ferry and thanks very much to our special guest, Billy Sloan. It's been a brilliant 55 minutes. I know you've enjoyed it as well. Speak to you next week. Bye-bye.